Today we complete our circumambulation, our journey around the mandala, at least this first journey that we're making in this first week of the retreat. And we're coming to the centre of the mandala. And in order to do that, we've had to develop integration and positive emotion, some insight to go through the stage of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. We've also had to let go of hatred and aversion, of pride, of craving and clinging and holding on, and envy. And having done that, at least in imagination, we arrive right at the heart of the mandala. And what we find when we arrive at the centre of the mandala is a figure. It's the figure of Vairochana, the illuminator, the one who lights up everything. And he's pure white in colour. Once again, seated on the lotus and moon mat, so a white lotus and a white moon mat, usually. And again, dressed in jewels and silks, because his state of mind is incredibly rich. His consciousness is adorned with all kinds of positive qualities. And his body gives off light. And the central thing about him is that he's holding a golden wheel. And this golden wheel symbolizes the Dharma. And he's holding it with a mudra, with a hand gesture, kind of like that. So his left hand is usually represented as supporting the wheel, and the right hand, you could imagine, is turning it. As we go around the mandala, the mudras kind of rise up, don't they? You start with earth touching and generosity, which are hands are reaching down. And then you have the mudra of meditation, and then the Abhaya mudra with the palm going up. So I don't know what that means exactly, but it's interesting that there's that sort of movement through. And so Vairochana's right hand in a way is more active, the left is more supportive. And in general, in Indo-Tibetan tradition, the right side represents the active side, active compassion, active skillful means, going out into the world, going out into the world of appearances, into that dream world of appearances, in order to transform it, in order to help beings to become free. And the left side is more the wisdom side. It's more the receptive side. It's the side which just sees how things are. It's the side that sees that everything is ungraspable. So there's no point trying to grasp it. So you can just relax and let go. So this is the figure, the central figure of the mandala. And he is an image of centrality. White is a colour which includes all the other colours. It's also an image of illumination. As I say, his name means the illuminator. And he's associated with space, with the lion. His lotus throne is often supported by great lions. So there's something, a suggestion about kingship and royalty there somewhere. And yes, he's associated with whiteness, with the centre, and with what's called the Dharmadhatu wisdom, the wisdom of the sphere of reality. I suspect we'll probably hear about more about that next week. He has in his Buddha family, or Tathagata family as it's known, a number of figures, of whom the best known is Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And his seed syllable is Om, as in Om Ah Om. And his mantra is just Om Vairochana Hum. Om Vairochana Hum. And because he's right at the centre, there are fewer associations with him than with some of the other Buddhas. For instance, he doesn't, in a sense, have a direction or a time of day associated with him. It sort of suggests that when we get to the centre of the mandala, we're on a level of awareness that isn't limited or conditioned by space or time. We've gone right beyond that. And Vairochana is also one other association that there is with him, though, is that he's associated with overcoming ignorance. Ignorance, in the normal sense of unknowing, but in particular in the sense of dullness, just dulling out. He's also associated with the Deva realms, with the realm of the beings who are dwelling in more refined states of awareness. And with pacifying, with bringing peace and calm to situations. And also with the crown chakra, right, the very top of the head. So from those associations with the devas, with pacifying, and perhaps even with the crown chakra, you can have a sense of ease, relaxation, nothing to do. It's like once you've got to the centre, once you've got to the crown, once you've got to the summit, there's nowhere else really to go. There's no more to do. You've just done it all. So you just sit and relax and enjoy it. So you could kind of associate Vairochana with, yes, that sort of comfortable being on a lounger by the pool, you know, in some Deva realm somewhere, with the sun of Vairochana just kind of relaxing you. The only trouble with that is that usually in situations like that, when we relax and the pressure comes off and there's nothing to do, we dull out. That's where that dulling kind of ignorance often comes in. So why is that, if that's true? Well, firstly, often that's our response because the effort that we've been making to get to that point isn't usually very balanced. Generally speaking, in the 21st century, in the West, human beings tend to alternate between a state of kind of hyperactivity, and along with that, a kind of hyper alertness, constantly looking for the next thing, constantly checking things out, constantly checking the net, checking the mobile, checking what's on TV, etc., etc. Constantly, on the sort of yellow alert. And in that, there's lots of unnecessary tension. So that's one side, but then you can only keep that up for so long. So as soon as the stimulus stops, or as soon as you just can't take that anymore, you flop over from hyper-aware, hyper-intensity, to slump. In whatever your preferred slump mudra is, you know, whether it's your favourite sort of slump realm, whether it's on the net or in front of the TV or whatever. Yeah. So a lot of people in our society, they're going very fast, they're very driven, and when they manage to find respite from that, they find respite in dulling out. And then, or they try and find respite in even more stimulus, which is even worse in a way. And then they kind of sleep that off, and the next day get up and do it all over again. Sort of out of bed, alarm clock goes, away you go, off and running. And then slump, and pick up slump, on and on. So that is not quite what Buddhism means by balanced effort, believe it or not. Vairochana, on the other hand, he unites all the sort of, well, because he's at the centre, he unites all the qualities of the different sides. So, for instance, he unites all that sense of warmth and wealth and relaxation that there is in the south, in Ratnasambhava's realm, with all the energy of Amoka City, all that outward going activity. But also he adds his own awareness, his own illuminating knowing of how things are, making everything clear, bright and sharp. So then you actually have a real balanced awareness and a balanced effort. So one reason we dull out is because we're not practicing balanced effort. We haven't been balanced before. We've been driven, we've been going too hard, we've been overstimulated, so then we slump, we dull out. The second reason we often dull out is because there's nothing interesting or exciting going on. We get very used to lots of stimulus. So when the stimulus isn't there, ho-hum, life suddenly is boring. Terrible word. So we can dull out in this way in meditation when there's nothing particularly interesting and exciting going on. But just more generally, also when life is easy and undemanding, we can do it on a big scale even. If things are going very well, you can dull out in the sense of just going off the boil spiritually. There's nothing driving you forward. Yeah, so when there's nothing interesting or exciting going on, we tend to experience boredom. And boredom is a really interesting state of mind. It's actually a really important state of mind. Because boredom is a gateway. It's a gateway to deeper states. Boredom. What is boredom? Boredom is actually ego starvation. That's what boredom is, generally. Yeah. When the ego has no project, when it has nothing to get hold of, then boredom arises. There's nothing to do. Because the ego thrives on drama. It thrives on lots happening. It thrives on that sort of, you know, my ego thrives on my personal kind of soap opera that I kind of create and keep going, you know, episode after episode, day after day. So a lot of the time we just create, if not drama, then at least, you know, interesting storylines for ourselves to keep that whole sense of me up and running. And if we can't, if we don't have any personal drama going on, well, there's lots, again, with all the media and so on, there's lots of off-the-peg drama that we can follow, whether it's films or the football or, you know, whatever it is, news. You know, we're constantly being offered drama to get involved with, so that we feel really stimulated and we feel for this and against that and concerned about this and, oh my God, we're 2-0 down and what's going to happen to her, you know, at the end of reel three. All that just keeps a strong sense of me going. And we become very used to this, if we're not careful, in the 21st century. So that even on retreat, we can manage to overstimulate ourselves quite easily. Yeah, we just go from a talk, which is either boring or stimulating, I leave it to you, and into discussion groups, and then there's lunch, and then there's sometime later on in the day there's some space. But, you know, you've got some books with you, so that's all right. You can just keep on sort of, you know, adding in more stimulus. And in that way, even on retreat, you never quite actually stop and just do nothing. You just keep on taking in and taking in and taking in. And that balance is completely lost. I sometimes say that, you know, in these days there's a lot of concern about sort of obesity, and there's all these sadly overweight people. But if we could sort of somehow body out our kind of minds and see the kind of diet that we give it and the way that we just keep on stuffing it, we keep on feeding its face, you know, sort of day after day, hour after hour, you know, sometimes with junk food, but at least with something, you just keep on taking in. Yeah, most of us are sort of mentally extremely obese, you know, we'd be kind of more or less being kind of pushed around in wheelchairs. So part of Dharma practice is doing our best to reduce at least some unnecessary input. Remember years ago, Sangharakshita, he gave a list of 15 points for order members, sort of 15 precepts. And the first one was reduce input. And I'm still working on that one. So yes, boredom is a sign that you're getting a little bit closer to all those kind of, all that ego story quietening down. I mean, it can quieten down in other ways. You can sometimes happen without you feeling bored. But boredom is very interesting. It's really good to turn towards it. If I go away on solitary retreat, you know, very often I've been very busy kind of answering all those emails before I go away. I've got a lot to do. I'm going away for 3 weeks. And so I arrive at this sort of idyllic cottage somewhere. And to start with, although I can see that it looks really nice, I have a bit of a sense of lack, of empty. Suddenly there's just me and these four walls. And so what? Why did I decide to come here? And there's just, you know, there's nothing to do. There's no stimulus. You know, all those sorts of questions I ask myself that, you know, your friends might ask you about what you're doing going on retreat over Christmas. You know, and you're not going to watch TV, and you're not going to do this, and you're not going to see lots of people, and you're not going to, yeah, there's just me and the four walls. But I've learnt that that's just a stage that I have to go through. It's as if, provided I just stay with what's going on and I stay with what's happening, to start with, it feels very tasteless, very flavourless. There's just nothing much there. But then as time goes on, it's as if I sort of fill the space. My inner world, my inner riches start to fill these four walls of this cottage, and it becomes increasingly fulfilling, and things start to deepen. So I often think there are a couple of dragons that kind of guard the treasure of deeper experience. One is boredom. One is you have to be prepared to go through that point where you're not just taking in more stimulus from outside, and you go cold turkey a bit on that for a little while, and then you experience that kind of rather nothingy, flavourless state But then you just sit with that. You just wait with that, as Subhuti says in his talks on just sitting. It's a sort of phase that you go through. And then, as you do that, after a while, you make deeper contact with your feelings. And then often the second dragon appears, which is that the first feelings that pop up at that point are usually uncomfortable. They're grief or anger or different things. Often it's the grief of the fact that you've been out of touch with those deeper feelings because you've been living on the surface of life, you know, just busy, 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 taking in, taking in, taking in. And that contact with the depths of yourself, with the depths of your feeling, with the depths of your experience, even contact with your body, has been lost. And so the journey back into that deep contact sometimes goes through boredom and then sadness or unpleasant feeling. In a way, it's just all those feelings coming up saying, oh, good, right, you've actually made some space now, as we said the other day. You know, here we are, we'd be delighted to spend some time with you and for you to spend some time with us and for you to give us some attention. And then beyond that, everything becomes much more rich and fulfilling, and you're in touch with the body, you're in touch with feeling, you're in touch much more with life. So, boredom is a gateway. It's important. And learning to do nothing is also important. It needs to be part of our practice somewhere. Just doing nothing. And learning to appreciate and enjoy just giving ourselves that space. It's as if we kind of, yeah, we often have to go up through the gears to deal with life. But then it's as if we keep coming back to neutral. You know, rather than just constantly going, 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 we just take a little bit of time and we come back to neutral. And we just relax and we let our mind just open. Nothing special to do. Just being a human being. We spend a lot of time sort of proving ourselves in some kind of way as human beings, proving, you know, that we have to be this kind of person and that kind of person and that we're, you know, up to life. Actually, we don't need to do that fundamentally. We just are human beings with rich hearts, amazingly kind of sensitive physical bodies and amazing capacities. It's enough in a way just to sit with that, just to be that. So giving yourself just a little bit of space, at least on retreat, and if at all possible, even just for a little bit each day, where you just stop, in a way you're coming to the centre of the mandala. At the centre of the mandala, there isn't anything to do. You just are it. There you are. You've arrived. So, learning that quite difficult art of just being with yourself, just tuning in, just being here, just taking in what's here, is, yeah, a really vital practice. A really vital practice. Vairochana is called the illuminator, and apart from this golden wheel, the main image associated with him is just of the sun. Yes. In a way, the golden wheel is also a kind of sun that he's holding. It's sort of shining out. And he's associated with the element of space. So the central image is of the sun radiating light into space. It's kind of the light of awareness pervading the limitless space of mind. Just to take that as an image. So again, it's as if on the highest level, there isn't anything to do. It's enough just that we savor and appreciate our awareness. Just let it radiate out, illumine all our experience. Just appreciating our experience. Appreciating it rather than going out and appropriating it, as Ratnaprabha and Chakupala put it. So rather than acting from that kind of ego story basis, where we're in life for what we can get out of it, we move into the world of spiritual receptivity, which is the aspect of the system of meditation that is associated with Vairochana by Subhuti and Kamalashila. So that's at the centre of the mandala of spiritual practice, spiritual receptivity. And in general, that's receptivity to all aspects of the Dharma life, sort of being receptive to Dharma qualities, being receptive to ethics, meditation and wisdom. Just as space is receptive to the sun's rays, just as space is receptive to the sun, so we're kind of receptive to the influence of the Dharma. So spiritual receptivity is at the centre of the mandala, and it also plays out in all the different aspects of the mandala. So in the east, in Akshobhya's realm, it plays out particularly in awareness of ourselves, awareness of body and mind, and direct experience of body and mind, just being open, receptive to what is our actual experience as human beings. What is our experience of the body? What actually is our experience of our feelings? What is our experience of thoughts? What are thoughts anyway, actually? Looking at all that. And then as we move round the mandala, we go into the south, into Ratnasambhava's realm, and here our receptivity becomes receptivity to others. His mudra is generosity, and he's associated with all the qualities of positive emotion. And all positive emotion is an opening beyond ourselves in different ways. So spiritual receptivity here is all about an open heart. Having an open heart to life, to all the suffering of life, so there's compassion, but also openness to the qualities that we see around us. So there's mudita, there's rejoicing as well. And then we go another 90 degrees on in the mandala, we come to the west and to Amitabha, who is about, we come into the part of the mandala that's about insight, about spiritual death. So here, the receptivity is to the nature of things, is to how things are, and to being receptive to letting go of our fixed views, our assumptions, and our various ego positions. So if we deconstruct those through receptivity to right view, and finally receptivity to perfect vision. And having done that, we come to the north, where we have spiritual rebirth. And when we arrive at this stage, we're receptive to the influence of what goes beyond our everyday selves. We're receptive to the influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You can put it in terms of blessing. So if we're receptive to that stream of transforming influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, however you want to see that, Subhuti and Sangharakshita are talking currently about almost like a sort of transpersonal force or power that Sangharakshita at times felt was just working through him. He felt in a way he as an everyday individual didn't start Sri Ratna. It's almost like there was something that, without going into making it metaphysical, but just his way of describing his experience of starting the movement, and at times even before that, sort of working for the Dharma, was it was as if he wasn't doing it, as if there was something coming through him that was doing it, something that was, you could imagine more as a bodhisattva sort of working, a bodhicitta working through him. So we become receptive to that mystery, receptive to the possibility of something arising beyond our everyday selves. Actually, if we look at it almost, never mind that very high level, if I just look at my life, actually, all the best things I've done, I don't feel as if I did them in a funny kind of way. It's like all the best bits of writing I've done, I feel like I didn't quite write that. It's almost like what fits my experience more is like the kind of old thing about the muses in Greek. It's like if I write a poem, if it's a very bad poem, sometimes you just think, oh yes, I put it down. But if it's a bit better than that, it feels as if it sort of just came through me. There it was, and I almost read it like any other person would come and read it. I have to get to know it. It's as if I didn't do it. Sometimes just with generosity, it's as if there's a situation and somebody needs something, and on a good day I may just find myself kind of offering, and then there's part of me going, oh, you're not going to do that, oh no, I needed that, I've just given it away. But it's like that, it wasn't everyday ego me that kind of set up a committee to decide and then decided to give. It was as if it just happened through me, bang. So yeah, even on that level we get a sense of the beginnings of something that feels beyond everyday us, and we turn towards that and we're receptive to that. So receptivity goes into all the different aspects of our practice, and the way of meditating, if you can say this, that is associated with spiritual receptivity is just sitting. It's a kind of a non-meditation, really, because you're not using any particular structure or method. You're just sitting. And that just sitting, simply being aware of whatever arises without grasping onto it, letting it come, letting it go, easy come, easy go. That just sitting needs to be an element in our practice all the way through our spiritual life. It's a very good place to start and end any practice. Over this week, when I've been leading things, I've been kind of starting, you'll have noticed, just with a little bit of space, where again, we're just not doing anything. It is very easy to make meditation, your daily meditation practice, into another thing to do. And that just builds up resistance. If meditation is another thing to kind of check off your to-do list, then that won't do it. Also, very often, if you try to plunge straight into meditation, Your mind isn't ready. And if you try to do it, there's a kind of meditative mood that you can sort of feel your way towards that helps. If you go from kind of running full tilt and now it's time for meditation and you go straight in, your mind isn't really prepared. And again, that builds up resistance, so then your mind produces more thinking as a result of that, and so the whole thing gets harder. Also, if you push in meditation, if you've decided, you know, where you're going to get to and you try to push, again, that creates resistance. So to start, just coming to your cushion and doing nothing gives your mind a chance to adapt and to just prepare itself, maybe even to digest a little bit of what you've just been doing. And it also breaks down that sense of got to get through the practice. No force. Yeah. It's the kind of foundation stone of meditation is that it's something you engage in very freely and with a lot of relaxation. So to help just get that sense, just to remind yourself of that, you just sit there. Just sit there and enjoy. Just savour the fact that there isn't anything to do right now. That you've just given yourself that space. And you can just enjoy it. And then, when it feels right, okay, you might want to move into doing something more structured. But having that little space to start with is very helpful. And the same again at the end. If you've been doing a structured practice of some sort, you've been doing mindfulness of breathing or metta bhavana or sadhana, whatever it is, just to leave a little space at the end where you absorb. You may have been working in the meditation, and again, you just let go. You just sit and feel what the meditation has done, how you are at the end. And you can try and get up with as much of that sense of nothing to do as possible. Very often, in everyday practice, okay, you sit and you relax, you come to the end of the practice, and then you think about what you've got to do next, and you kind of get geared up to do the next thing. You kind of put yourself, you know, you get back into gear, you know, sort of try and start straight from third very often, you know, and away you go. But it's interesting to see how much you can do almost with that sense of doing nothing, just with that same kind of relaxed sense. A lot of that gearing up and winding up is anxiety based. It's just tension that, you know, habitual tension based on anxiety. So it is possible to kind of go through into activity with much more of a sense of doing nothing in a sense. So it's good to end with that little space as well, of just sitting. And then just sitting is also important as a balance for your structured practice. In the early stages of your meditation practice, just sitting, doing a lot of just sitting probably isn't going to do much good. Because if you don't have enough clarity built up, if your awareness of what's going on is very weak, and you just give your mind nothing to do, then it will just do whatever it usually does, which is what it's been doing since beginningless time, which is producing its usual habitual tendencies. And the tendency is just to get lost in those. So if you just sit, allegedly, but you don't have the awareness, then you just, what will happen will be your habitual ways of thinking and being will be there, and you'll get carried off in them. You won't notice. Yeah. It's like when you're doing the mindfulness of breathing and you're supposed to be with the breath, but then you lose it and you're thinking about gardening or something suddenly. It's the same thing. But with just sitting, you haven't got any anchor. You haven't got a structure. You haven't got anything that you're supposed to be keeping your focus on. And so it's easier for that drift, that just losing of awareness to happen, just getting carried off in the flow of thoughts. So it's not helpful to do just sitting on that basis, because in a way you're just cultivating doing what you usually do. You're just cultivating those habitual tendencies. But it is helpful to do at least some, just to get into this sense of having a kind of balance, a balance between doing and not doing, a balance between creating, working on development, and that sense of, well, there's nothing that has to happen, just complete relaxation, just letting go. And so just some just sitting keeps that element of letting go, just complete relaxation, not trying to get anywhere, because we live in a very goal-oriented society. So it's important that we keep bringing in that element that is not goal-oriented. On a certain level, it's not even oriented to the goal of gaining enlightenment. We're just being aware, just with our experience now. And if we do that deeply enough, well, of course, we will attain enlightenment finally. But that sense of having to get somewhere else, which we have in so much of our activity, to that goal over there, we carry that into our Dharma activity. And yes, there is a path and there are stages, but fundamentally everything comes out of deepening into the present moment, deepening into our current awareness. And when you have a sense of got to get to the goal, you discount and dismiss your current experience, and that doesn't help, that doesn't work. So yeah, it's good to have a balance. Yeah, sure. We practice mindfulness of breathing, we practice metta bhavana, we practice insight practice of one sort or another, maybe. But yes, then also, there's just that element where we just aren't practicing anything. We are just here. We're just aware. We're just experiencing. And that's quite enough. And there's just real relaxation, because we're not trying to do anything. We can let ourselves just really let go. So just sitting is good as a good place to start and end for practice. It's good to do at times as a balance alongside some structured practice. It's also, as you go further on, just sitting becomes more important. Just sitting, being receptive, becomes just being receptive to the Dharma, just being receptive to the influence of the Dharma, just being receptive to the influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It becomes more central practice. And finally, as you go further even, just sitting becomes the practice, because there is nowhere to go. You see that it is all finally in this moment, and also you see that the the everyday you who was creating the ego project is an illusion. And then just sitting may be all you do. And at that point you're acting from spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. You're acting from a non-egoic basis. And at that point you can truly turn the wheel of the Dharma. Which brings us back to Vairochana and his golden wheel, which usually has eight spokes, which symbolise the Noble Eightfold Path. So we have this brilliant white figure turning the wheel of the Dharma. So he's spreading the Dharma. The Buddha's first teaching in the deer park at Sarnath is referred to as his turning the wheel of the Dharma. When he first set the wheel of the Dharma in motion, when he first communicated the Dharma, and that wheel has carried on rolling down through the centuries across the world, right into this retreat centre. So the fact that we come to the centre of the mandala and we find a Buddha turning the wheel of the Dharma also suggests something about when you complete a cycle of practice, it's important that in some way you share what you've learnt, you share what you've seen. This is the Bodhisattva ideal. That we, yeah, you don't just keep things to yourself. You don't just think, oh, you know, I learnt all this stuff and I've got all these notes and I shall go away and study them. It will do me a lot of good. Hopefully it will, but we're connected to so many other people who haven't found the Dharma, and we may not feel like we've taken it in very deeply, we may not feel like we've got very far, and I don't mean this in any sort of patronising way, but there are so many other people out there who are just lost in suffering, who do not have the basics, who don't have the beginning of a clue. It's like just being here, you know, on our level. I never think about, you know, whether I've left my wallet kind of lying around or something like that. I don't need to. It's just a sort of basic level of precepts that we've just got, that we can kind of share. And, you know, even if the world, just on the most basic level of the five precepts, you know, was operating in that way, the world would be transformed completely. Yeah. I was reading recently a statistic that in the 20th century, well, estimates vary, but at least 105 million human beings, and maybe 170 million human beings, were killed by other human beings. Huge number. Even just having sufficient awareness of the Dharma to think that, well, you know, killing is not a good idea, generally speaking. Even that, we don't share with a lot of the human race, even. So when we take in bits of Dharma, firstly, yeah, we always, traditionally, if you hear a bit of Dharma, you try to apply it as soon as possible, the same day, because you don't wait. If there's any way to do it, you just put it into practice, because that immediately, you know, that gives your mind that sense of, right, yes, you know, we're going to do this. You put it off and think, oh well, you know, when I get round to it in a few weeks' time, or, you know, sometime later in the year when I get my notes out about what Ratnaprabha said or whatever, that doesn't do it. So yeah, you apply it in some way or another straight away. But also, you always see if there's some way in which you can share it, in some way in which you can pass it on. You may not be, you know, I'm not saying, oh, we all have to go home and stand up and give Dharma talks in your local kind of shopping centre. But, yeah, in some way, to some people, yeah, if you can find ways to just share what you know, what you've seen, what you've learnt, then that will just have a little bit of an effect on the world. And if you can't think of any way to do that, or perhaps there's some way in which you can help someone else who could do that to do so. Okay, so we've looked at Vairochana, we've looked at that tendency to dull out, we've looked at unbalanced effort, we've looked at boredom and the importance of boredom as a gateway, we've looked at the tendency that we have to mental flabbiness and obesity because of the diet that we're taking in, which is far too rich and far too constant. We're constantly kind of snacking mentally on one thing or another. We've looked at just spending a little bit of time doing nothing. And we've seen that Vairochana is the illuminator. He's like a great sun of awareness, filling space. And that openness of space to the sun is an image for spiritual receptivity, which applies in all the different aspects of the mandala. And the practice connected with spiritual receptivity is just sitting, which is a good place to start and end a period of practice, which is good to have as a balance to your more structured practice, and which over time becomes more and more important, becomes more and more central, and particularly as you move more into the sort of insight dimension of things, because you start examining who it is who's trying to gain enlightenment and see more and more that there is nowhere to go and no one to gain anything. And we've seen that Vairochana's turning of the wheel at the end of our journey around the mandala also suggests the Bodhisattva ideal, also suggests in some way or another passing things on.